Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The 2025-26 school year was an eventful one for Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. Last fall, Operation Charlotte's Web, the federal operation targeting the immigrant community, resulted in an enormous number of absences among children fearing getting caught up in the raids. And in the early summer, there were skirmishes between the school board and the superintendent over the proposed budget. Dr. Crystal Hill went back to the drawing board, and the second iteration of that budget passed unanimously, but it was clear that there was friction in that relationship. Weeks later, the board decided to put Hill on paid leave while they conduct an investigation into matters involving administrative and operational oversight. That's a quote. Hill says she remains in the dark about exactly what they are looking for. So this hour, we recap some of the milestones of this past school year and look ahead to the fall. We're joined by WFAE's education reporter, James Farrell. He's here along with Hannah McClellan, Director of News and Content for Education NC. And Emma Broughton is Director of Digital Learning at the Friday Institute for Educational Innovation at NC State University. Good morning, everybody. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
So, James, let me start with you as our education reporter. Aside from the bookend stories that I just referred to, the Border Patrol raids in Charlotte and their impact, particularly on the Hispanic community and Hispanic students at CMS, and then the placing of the superintendent on leave just in the last couple of weeks, how would you describe the year at CMS?
It was a very eventful year for sure. I mean, those two bookend things were really big stories for any school year. You know, I think it was also a surprising school year, kind of the turn of events of what happened with the superintendent kind of, I think, seemed to kind of take people by surprise a little bit. At the beginning of the year, the school board and the superintendent seemed to have a pretty good working relationship. And then, like you mentioned, we watched that kind of deteriorate a little bit during the budget process. And now we're in this phase of this investigation and waiting to see what comes from that. You know, we're going to talk about, there was a lot of conversation about tech in classrooms. So there were a lot of kind of surprising storylines that came out of this school year. We had two snowstorms here, which was very surprising as well. Let's not forget that. So I would describe it as kind of surprising. There were some surprising storylines that came out of this school year.
So Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Border Patrol conducted raids in various cities around the country, including Charlotte, prior to those operations, because we saw this happening in those other cities like Chicago. There was concern about what protections might be in place to protect students and their parents who were dropping them off at various schools, protections from these raids. What conclusions were reached, and were whatever protections CMS had planned for effective in doing that job, or did the students simply not show up?
Yeah, it's hard to say. Like you mentioned, there was a lot of tension about this issue even prior to Border Patrol coming here, because we were seeing on the news this was happening in other cities. And I think one of the big drivers of this was the fact that the Trump administration removed those protections from schools at the beginning of the year, where they said immigration agents can go into schools, which has historically not been the case. I think that created a lot of fear, legitimate fear in communities that we could be dealing with this issue that we have not seen before. We saw around the country, school districts were kind of scrambling to try to come up with policies. What do we do if Border Patrol comes? How do we handle that? CMS was no different. This was a big debate in the community. People were coming out to meetings. They were expressing concern. They wanted CMS to do more to kind of just say, we don't want agents in these schools at all. CMS was trying to create a policy that, you know, treated Border Patrol like any other law enforcement agency, where there's restrictions as to where they can go, but the lobbies are obviously public spaces where they could go into. Some people in the community were not happy with that. This came to a head even before Border Patrol came, because we saw that parent who was detained outside of a school or near a school. But I just think it's interesting because we didn't see Border Patrol enter any schools while they were here in Charlotte, but it still had this huge impact on schools, which I think just speaks to the impact of that policy that I mentioned, that change in philosophy of allowing immigration agents to go there. So we didn't actually get to see if these policies were effective per se because Border Patrol didn't enter schools, but I think it just highlights how tense the situation became just when we knew that this was even a possibility that could happen, which historically has not been the case.
Hannah, you cover the schools statewide, not just here in Charlotte. And Charlotte was not the only school system in the state affected by these Border Patrol actions. How did other systems handle the threat, if that's the correct word, and the reality of what occurred? How did they handle the situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think to James' point, we didn't see very many instances in which ICE agents actually entered school grounds. There were a few instances of raids being near or close to early childhood facilities. But I think, like James is saying, I think that the fear was enough to have a big impact on impacted districts across the state and really across the country. And I think research is really clear that all kids need to be in classrooms for the best learning and consistency to happen. And so I think you see a very strong nonpartisan commitment really across North Carolina from educators to support policies that allow all students to feel safe in coming to school and accessing the resources that are meant to help them thrive. And I think at the same time as you're seeing this, we saw this change in immigration raids able to happen at schools. There's also been a bunch of other changes that impacted these students. And so I think really school districts across North Carolina are working together to try to creatively keep serving these students and make sure that they know that school is still a place for them.
It's my impression, and it could be completely wrong, that mostly urban districts were targeted by these Border Patrol activities. Mecklenburg County, of course, being one of them, Wake County and Raleigh being another, perhaps Guilford County to a certain extent, which is the home county of Greensboro. Were there other counties? Were there more rural counties who also felt the impact of this, Hannah?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that the urban counties were the ones that were targeted. I do think there are large populations of immigrant students in our rural counties as well. And so I think the fear of like, am I safe to go to school if I go and this happens? Like, what will happen to me? What will happen to my family? And so I think even our rural districts were dealing with trying to communicate actively with parents and families to know, like, here are your rights. Here is the process for like what happens if ICE agents are on school campus, and really trying to proactively make sure that families knew what was going on and knew what would happen in the event that there was a raid near or on campus.
There was a lot of fear of the unknown among parents, particularly, and one of those unknowns was exactly what would happen and could schools really get in the way of Border Patrol executing what they plan to do. And at one point, James, 30,000 students from CMS were affected by these actions. They didn't show up for school. How long did those absences last, and what lingering effects have there been from those absences?
Yeah, so they lasted, to my knowledge, pretty much the duration of Border Patrol's stay here. Every day we were seeing public records requests coming out and seeing those absences continue to remain elevated. If I remember correctly, I think they came down a little bit, but they were still higher than what you would normally expect. I think it'll be interesting to see in the fall when we get state test results that come out. I'm interested to see if there's any impact from those prolonged absences in that data at all. And I think there's actually, even outside of immigration for a second, I mean, we did lose a lot of school this year because of the weather. So I'm curious to see if any of that impacts test scores at all. And I think we'll get a better sense there. But emotionally, I think there's also lingering impacts as well. And I remember speaking to families and parents at the time who were talking about just their kids being afraid to go to school, even, you know, in cases where they're citizens and they were worried about going to school, and just hearing on the news about citizens being questioned and not wanting to do that. I remember speaking to teachers who were saying they were walking into half-empty classrooms. So that stuff leaves a mark, especially on young kids. And I'm sure a lot of parents would tell you that that impact is going to continue to last. We certainly saw a lot of philanthropic efforts continuing, families who set up food banks or things to like try to get food to families who were afraid. Those continued on for a while after Border Patrol left as well, because some people were still afraid. So there was definitely a lingering impact in terms of like whether there's data. I think we'll get a better idea if this impacted anything academically in the fall.
Emma Broughton is with us. She is the Director of Digital Learning for the Friday Institute for Educational Innovation at North Carolina State University. And we're going to talk a lot this hour about digital technology in the classroom. But one area where we should start, I guess, would be the role that digital technology played in all of what we're talking about. Operation Charlotte's Web, for instance. We know that during the pandemic, school was almost exclusively online. I'm assuming that CMS and other districts made use of their online technology during that period, Operations Web, Charlotte's Web period of what happened in the fall. What role did technology play in that? And was it any better or any more effective than it was during the pandemic? Do you know?
Just a little bit here. Good morning. Thank you for your question. I think that we saw many schools or individual teachers even try to respond by offering support to their students as they would any student who was absent during the day. And so there was opportunity for many schools and classrooms to go into some version of remote learning. The challenge, of course, being the hybrid nature of it then, where you've got students that are in person or students that are at home, and how do you balance both of those learning environments. And so I think lessons learned during the pandemic definitely have helped to contribute during these types of events, or the weather events as well, where folks are more easily able to navigate and provide those supports. But like James mentioned, it'll be interesting to see if any of that is reflected in the test scores coming up, and how folks were able to respond and provide those gaps in services.
James.
Yeah, just to kind of localize that a little bit too, here at CMS, I know this was a big debate. There were a lot of people in the community who were calling on CMS to go to remote during this. CMS ultimately opted not to do that. Superintendent Hill at the time had said that, in the midst of all this chaos, they wanted CMS to offer stability. There was a belief that school would still be the safest place for kids, and that's ultimately why they did that. But I think that that's kind of an interesting tension that played out during that period of time.
We ended the year, of course, here at CMS with indications of rising tensions, which we've referred to, between the CMS school board and the superintendent. This year brought a new board into power with a lot of new members on that board. For the first time in memory, all of the members of the school board are Democrats. Is that the root of the rising tensions, that these are new members who were not involved in Crystal Hill's selection several years ago, or new members simply wanting to put their stamp on school operations, or politics coming into play with Dr. Hill caught in the crossfire?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that all of us would like maybe some more clarity on that, some more transparency on that, some answers as to what actually is kind of going on here with this investigation. You know, I think anytime you have new board members that come in, they start looking at the way the district is run, they have questions. We saw that play out a little bit in the budget process. We heard a lot of questions about things. I know behind the scenes, there was a lot of frustration with CMS staff about the kinds of answers that they were getting about different things in the budget, and that created some tension and some friction. So yeah, I think the fact that it is a new board probably did play a role. I would say it was a little surprising because at the start of their tenure, it seemed like they were getting along really well with Dr. Hill. There had been, it had actually been like a talking point during the election that maybe this board would be really friendly with Hill, almost overly deferential, which obviously has not played out to be the case. So, I think that part of it is a little surprising.
I want to talk a little bit more about the friction between the board and Dr. Hill, because she's on paid leave as they investigate. And we're going to find out if we know anything more about what they're investigating, because she says she's in the dark about that. We'll come back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the school year that just ended at CMS and other school things around the state, public education-wise, with James Farrell. He's our education reporter at WFAE News. Hannah McClellan is here, director of news and content for Education NC, and Emma Broughton, the director of digital learning for the Friday Institute for Educational Innovation at NC State University. All here. So friction became apparent, James, between the CMS board and Dr. Hill in the late spring, early summer, as they were discussing her proposed budget, which they didn't like, and they dismissed her peremptorily, tersely, I guess is the better word. And she went back to the drawing board. She came back with the new budget about a week or so later. They passed it unanimously. They praised her on both ends of the things that she has done while in office at the CMS. They praised her before they rejected the budget. They praised her after they rejected the budget. And then they put her on paid leave and praised her again. So what's going on here? Were those tensions apparent prior to the budget process? And do we have any clue as to what it is they are investigating?
I don't think that those tensions were very apparent before the budget process. I think they really came to light during these budget discussions. Even during the budget discussions in the kind of first half of it, the board was asking a lot of questions. I personally wouldn't have described those questions as like overly tense or combative or anything. So when they voted against the budget, I mean, personally, I was a little surprised that that had happened. I think Dr. Hill seemed surprised, at least at the meeting, that it was coming. We now know that behind the scenes and from what board members have said, they felt like they had a lot of unanswered questions. They were hearing a lot of concerns from the community about things like mental health and wanting to make sure the budget aligned with district priorities. So I think there was some of that at work, too. They were trying to be responsive to what they were hearing from the public. And I think they were also getting a little frustrated with what they were hearing from staff as well.
And what have you heard from parents and others in the public about what has been their reaction to what's going on?
Yeah, so obviously we don't know the exact reason why she's been put on leave yet. We're still waiting to see if that gets disclosed. In the past, with previous superintendents, it has not always been disclosed by the board. It's come out in the media and things like that. And the overwhelming sense that I've gotten from parents and teachers and other members of the community who I've spoken to is kind of a sense of like, well, here we go again, because we've had seven superintendents over the last 15 years. Nobody has lasted more than 3 years since Peter Gorman, who was from 2006 to 2011. The last couple of superintendents both kind of left with a cloud of like, well, what exactly happened here? And there were personnel issues that couldn't be discussed. One teacher I spoke to said that they were desensitized a little bit to all of this, that it almost becomes like a running joke that like next year we could have a different superintendent and we won't fully know exactly what happened. So I think there's some frustration about the feeling of a lack of stable leadership, having someone who actually can hold this position for a long time, questions about why that's the case. Is there some systemic issue that's making it difficult for superintendents to stay in this position for a long time? And most importantly, I think there's some questions about transparency too. How can the public get, this is a personnel matter, obviously that's confidential, but how can the public get more information about what's happening with such an important position in this community?
Hannah, you cover this statewide. There's been, as James just said, a lot of superintendent turnover here with the average tenure about 2 to 3 years. Is that normal nationally? Is that normal in other districts in the state? Or are we unique in some way?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the 2 to 3 year average maybe isn't normal, but the amount of turnover, we're seeing that increasingly be normal in North Carolina districts and across the country. You know, I think that the superintendent job is just a very stressful one. At NC, we kind of like to talk about districts as big businesses and superintendents as CEOs. Of course, there's some things that don't exactly line up, and that the primary goal of a school isn't to make money, it's to serve students. But the point being that school districts oversee and operate a lot of money and a lot of employees in a lot of our counties across the state. The school district is the largest or second largest employer in the county. And that's true in Charlotte. I think in Charlotte, it's the third largest employer in the county. CMS has more employees than the Bank of America in Charlotte, for context. And so you can imagine that's a lot for one person to be responsible for. And at the same time, superintendents don't always make as much as a CEO in a private organization, similar to what they would be making if they were private. And so I think it's a lot of stress. They could be making more somewhere else. And there's also the fact that the job requires a lot of them, a lot of time, a lot of yeah. being kind of available 24/7 to a bunch of different constituents.
In Charlotte, we have a habit of rewarding superintendents by giving them raises and contract extensions, and less than a year later dismissing them peremptorily with very little information as to why. And this usually happens here in Charlotte with all of the recent superintendent departures. Again, is this something unique to Charlotte or unique to North Carolina, particularly when the public is not informed as to what exactly happened? Hannah.
Yeah, I don't know the specifics of Charlotte super well. I do think that it is a tricky tension. The fact that, as James said, these are personnel matters. And so I think there is this question of, like, a lot of people look to the superintendent as sort of the face of the school district. And so they want to know what went into this, what might seem sudden. It might not seem sudden to the board members, but if that's not transparent to the community, that creates a lot of questions. I think regardless of the outcome of this investigation in Charlotte, and you can look at other maybe less controversial resignations and things happening elsewhere in the state, I think this just really emphasizes the need for stability for students, parents, and educators. The superintendent is really important in helping create that sense of stability and helping create and cast a vision that the school district can get behind and that can trickle down successfully to school communities, and so that every school, family, schools, parents, children can feel like they have access to a high quality education with educators that support them. And that gets hard when the leader is changing constantly.
So this will be an ongoing story for much of the summer. We will keep our eyes on that as we go forward. Emma is here, Emma Broughton from NC State University's Digital Learning Division. Technology, let's talk about that, because technology in schools has been getting a big spotlight of late. You are the director of the Digital Learning at the William and Ida Friday Institute for Educational Innovation. And clearly you see digital innovation as a tool that can help people recognize help in education. But do you recognize the need for the constant evaluation of those tools?
Yeah, absolutely. I come to this conversation as a lifelong educator myself. So I was a classroom teacher, a school librarian. I worked for a number of years at the state and then at the district leadership level as well. And the regular and consistent evaluations that starts with procurement and onboarding of technology all the way through implementation and then making decisions about when not to use or to stop using and offloading that technology is a huge time, a huge requirement of time on staff, not only at the technology decision maker level, but at the classroom and the school leader level as well. So you're thinking constantly about, is this the right technology to use? Is it for the learning purposes that I have for my students? And then what I'm able to accomplish with that time that's given to the screen for the students. So we see that changing quite a bit, especially post-COVID, when we had one-to-one devices for our students as they were coming back to the classroom. But a lot of our schools were saying, we want more FaceTime. We want more unplugged activities. And so you've seen that backlash continue to escalate with the bans on cell phones and the limits to screen time. The Department of Public Instruction just this past week published their own guidance around quality screen time use and purposeful screen time use. So that will be really interesting to see how that's rolled out and shared and discussed this coming year.
Some people used to view technology as the next logical step in education, and then along comes the pandemic, and suddenly everything is dependent on technology and screens, and we know that it didn't work out so well. Is that what has given people a bad taste in their mouth about technology, about student reliance on screens, Emma? And if so, is that fair? Because I don't think that that technology was ready to be used as a substitute completely for classroom education. And it didn't work out so well. Is that why people are upset about it?
I would say there has been bad implementation and bad use of technology at times. And so I definitely think that is something that people see, and there is reason to be concerned about it, especially for our younger grades. We want to make sure that we're preserving that time for unplugged learning and play. But I want to be careful that we're not treating all technology use as the same, because there are times where technology is used for substitution, but there also are times where we have meaningful use of it, and it might be allowing us to do things that were previously inconceivable. And so we're seeing, you know, this big conversation that we would say it's not something that's new. We've been talking about it when we started to talk about digital citizenship 20 years ago, and thinking about healthy habits and when to use your device or your machine or when not to do that. And so a conversation, I think, has just continued to emerge and grow as more people are paying attention to it. More screens are prevalent. We see younger and younger children having their own personal devices at home. And so parents are seeing those habits that might be starting at home in the younger years and carry forward into school years and then come home after school. And so there's definitely a reason to be concerned about the decisions students are making with technology.
The New York Times reports that some, not all, some researchers have found that digital devices have failed to boost student test scores and graduation rates, and that they can also significantly detract from learning. And they add that a lot of school systems are ill-equipped to adequately vet classroom technology, which creates an enormous burden on those systems. Why is this all that different from evaluating textbooks and which books should be read as part of class assignments, etc.? Why is it so different?
Well, I want to start with the terms and conditions that are laid out by these vendors that provide these edtech platforms, because a lot of them are not readable to the average person. And I would make an argument that if you are going to tell me that this platform should be used by a fifth grader or a 13-year-old or an 18-year-old and above, that should be understandable. And so those terms and conditions sometimes are so full of legalese that it's hard to interpret what data is collected or what's the best use of this or what that should look like. And quite honestly, a lot of these platforms are created because people have this grand idea for this solution and they're seeking the problem to implement it back into schools. And so we might have some vendors who are telling us this is this grand solution, and it might not have an evidence or research base to say it's actually going to move the needle. And so we have to be really careful about who is pushing the message about what's the right tech and when is the right tech, and really trust the teachers and the instructional leaders in the school and district to make those types of decisions.
In a story that the WFAE's education reporter James Farrell wrote about this, he quotes a student at a Montessori school who expressed views of what is called the iReady program, which is something that the CMS uses. And that student said, some people say it's too challenging or too easy. There's a lot of extra steps that we have to do. And the narration is annoying because you cannot skip it. People will have differing opinions about almost everything. Is this just another example of that? Or is this more of a basic struggle between man and machine?
Well, I think that you have a really nuanced conversation that needs to happen around the use of technology and why iReady may or may not be appropriate for the goals of that lesson or why that student is using that technology. And so oftentimes we see something like iReady come into the classroom to serve an original purpose that may no longer be necessary or may no longer be the same purpose. And so I say that it's nuanced because there are times where students are tasked with using a certain platform. And the reason they're on that platform is because the district or the school has said, we want to make sure that we're using this technology with fidelity based on what this vendor says. And they say in order to improve student scores, we have to see you on it for 20 minutes a day or 40 minutes a day. The other part of it, though, is that sometimes in schools, that 20 minutes or 40 minutes is actually the break that that teacher might get in their school day to have some planning or to meet with other teachers or to have a parent conference. And so you'll see sometimes that is part of a schedule issue because we might be understaffed or we're trying to find that opportunity for a teacher to have the lesson planning or that break in their day for planning purposes. And so there's a lot of reasons why those decisions are being made. And then there are times when we need to make sure that we are working with the technology to provide and design meaningful lessons for our students.
Hannah.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a pretty strong bipartisan commitment both among educators and lawmakers to try to figure out this tension. I think we've seen attempts with that with cell phone restrictions. There's also a social media age verification bill making its way through the General Assembly now. And there's also discussions of how to talk about and teach AI literacy in schools. I think a piece of this conversation that sometimes gets lost is the fact that, you know, technology is not going away. And so I think particularly for our older students, there has to be a balance of exposing students to these technologies and making sure they can use them. There has been some research coming out recently showing that, you know, the importance of schools in leveling access to this technology. Students from higher income families, of course, probably are always going to have access to devices, opportunities to learn about AI. And so when we're thinking about preparing students for life after school, the opportunity of having their own device to learn how to use technology and also to learn how to use AI well and develop those AI literacy skills are really important.
James, CMS just renewed the iReady contract, which was up for renewal for 1 year instead of two. We'll talk about that in a moment when we come back, but there may be people listening who have no clue as to what we're talking about. What exactly is iReady? What is it?
Yeah, so iReady is an online adaptive learning platform. The idea is that students take like an assessment at the beginning of the year that identifies their strengths and weaknesses, and then they do, CMS says they do 90 minutes of work on iReady per week to try and kind of hone in on those things that they're struggling with. It helps provide data for the district too as to how students are doing and where they might need improvement. It's important to note this is not just a CMS thing. iReady is all over the country. It's in a bunch of different school districts. And also the backlash here to iReady that we've seen is also not just a CMS thing. This has been a big national conversation about iReady and tech in general.
Is this a new way for students to learn at their own pace and to catch up with others if they have weaknesses in certain areas? Is that essentially what it is? And I have 5 seconds.
Yes, that's kind of the general idea behind it.
So we'll come back and talk about the pushback to iReady from parents and the decision to only renew it for a year at CMS in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the school year that has just come and gone at CMS and around the state. James Farrell is with us. He's our education reporter at WFAE News. Emma Broughton is the Director of Digital Learning at the Friday Institute for Educational Innovation at NC State University. And Hannah McClellan is Director of News and Content for EdNC. Parents are pushing back, James, on technology in the classroom of all kinds, and including cell phones. But the CMS board recently questioned but passed a one-year extension of CMS's use of the iReady program. They signed a one-year extension of the contract. It was supposed to be a two-year extension. Why did they only cut the deal for one?
So like you mentioned, there had been a lot of questions about this, some tense conversations between the board and staff about why we use iReady. the proposal was originally for 2 years. They ultimately agreed on 1 year with the condition that the board would kind of that staff would kind of come back with other alternatives to iReady that they could potentially explore and kind of monitor its impact and see how it's being implemented across the district so that they could have kind of a better sense of what's going on. And I think the key thing here, Mike, is that iReady is a universal screener that all students take that they use to collect data. School districts are required to have a screener like this. CMS has chosen iReady. So the problem here is that if they were to just get rid of iReady, they would still need to find another screener. And I think that was a concern from board members. They couldn't just vote no on this because they would be left trying to find a new screener to replace it.
And they approved this during the period of absence of the school superintendent. Is that because they don't want to saddle a new superintendent with a 2-year contract when the superintendent may have ideas of their own? Or is this just coincidental?
I think it has more to do with the timing of the fact that all this backlash came with very short runway until this contract had to be renewed. And there was not that effort to put in to find alternatives, alternative vendors, alternative platforms that they could have explored to see if there was something that might be more palatable to the community than what iReady is offering.
The idea of each student having their own piece of technology, their own laptop, their own Chromebook, I think, originated with former Superintendent Clayton Wilcox, and it has continued. And of course, like all technology, it has to be updated and or replaced because it's abused by students or it wears out or it's lived its life cycle and we need to move on. Is the system rethinking this in any way, James, the idea of giving everybody their own laptop?
I think you're seeing some signs of this. I mean, one of the conversations that happened this week was that CMS had kind of at least vowed to take a better stock of how screen time is being handled across the district. You know, part of the iReady conversation here is a question not just about iReady, but whether it's actually being implemented with fidelity across the district, whether teachers are monitoring it the way that they should, whether kids are using it more than the district is saying that they are. And I think that's a big question parents have. So at least in word, CMS has said they're planning on kind of reassessing, making sure that screen time is being used appropriately in schools. We've also seen that CMS just recently committed to starting a kindergarten play program to allow for play-based learning. I think that also has ties to this as well. There's kind of concern from parents who want to see their kids doing more play activities, get off screens more, do kind of things that kids do more that's good for development and things like that. So you are seeing CMS wrestling with what they're hearing from the community and trying to find ways to make that work against the fact that in this modern world, technology is also just a big part in classrooms.
Hannah, CMS says the students only use iReady for about 90 minutes a week. I want you to put that into some sort of perspective. Is that a lot? And how does that compare to how other systems around the state may be using this kind of technology?
Yeah, I can't speak to the specifics of how many minutes each district is using the technology, but if you think about most students are actively in the classroom for about 7 to 8 hours a day, if 90 minutes a week is just a small part of that. I think, like Emma was talking about earlier, the goal is for these things to complement the teaching and provide teachers with more personalized data to be able to then go on and do follow-up and things like that with their students. I also think we're kind of at an inflection point where a lot of the one-to-one devices that you mentioned have hit their life cycle, and a lot of districts across the state don't actually have money set aside to replace those devices. A lot of devices were bought with COVID relief dollars during the pandemic, and so the Department of Public Instruction and State Board of Education have asked for state funding this short session to sort of start phasing in replacements of those devices across the state. And so I think that's a conversation we're going to see continue to play out as to which districts are able to even have the option of replacing those.
Emma, I remember when we used slide rules in classrooms, and that's how old I am. And there was a time when there was an argument about whether we should replace the slide rules or allow the slide rules to be replaced by calculators. We know what won. Prior to the early 20th century, teachers had chalkboards and maps and globes in the classroom. Then along came film strips and overhead projectors. They were supplanted later on by film and videotape and television sets. Were those innovations regarded with the same suspicions as computers and other devices are today?
So I think the difference between what you're describing and where we are in the classroom now is the level of accessibility and affordability of so many of these pieces of equipment or these devices. So as you mentioned the machine earlier, and we are always talking about the human and the machine or the human and the AI, because now with generative AI, things are so accessible for anyone to be able to talk to ChatGPT on their phone or to pull up Gemini or to engage with Claude or a chatbot. And so where we are now, where these are so prolific in our pockets or in our pocketbooks or on our desks versus what that access might have been 20 or 30 years ago is really changing. And what you describe, I think, is maybe very teacher-centered. The teacher, the adult in the room had access, and now we're talking about the students are having access and bringing their own devices in that may or may not go in a yonder pouch or be locked up during the day.
I want to talk about cell phones in a second. James, go ahead.
Yeah, just really quick, I just want to kind of add to that and say with that accessibility point, I think that part of what causes this tension is that parents are trying to manage this issue at home, and they're hearing so much research about the dangers of screen time, and they're trying to limit it, and they're setting rules at home, and then they find out that their kid is at school and has access to a device. And that can be frustrating when they feel like it's not going against what they're trying to enforce at home. And I think that goes to that accessibility point, that this is just so much more pervasive than, you know, like calculators and things like that.
Emma. I'll just chime in and say, when we talk to teachers and we talk about students on their cell phones, the number one audience that is texting the students are the parents. And so it's a really interesting tension that exists, that yes, parents are concerned, but then yes, parents are also texting. And so it's just a really unique problem to try and handle as we're thinking about it here.
Yes, cell phones have become a point of friction. And this is something that is happening all over the country. Some states, some 30 states actually, including our own, have enacted laws in the last 5 years requiring school districts to develop policies around cell phone use in schools. I'm curious as to what policies are in place in North Carolina, Emma, and what your organization recommends in terms of how these devices should be or should not be used.
Right. So a lot of school districts and schools have had policies for a very long time about digital use in classrooms or about cell phone use. Now, it was about how it was being implemented in classrooms and in schools that may have made the difference for what that looked like. And so I think what you're seeing now is more regulation and more bans or more restrictions on the day-to-day operations. And there's been some infrastructure and systems that have been created for principals and teachers to better make sure those policies are being enforced. So there's more conversation around it. And I always think that bringing that conversation to the classroom, to the school, to the home, to the dinner table is really important. But I want to add something here that I don't think is always discussed, that really the technology is so oftentimes that students encounter, it's designed to create this cycle of addiction for them. So it's not just a school issue, it's not just a ban issue, it is a design issue that we need to really place a lot of the responsibility on the developers and companies that are creating these systems, because we need to be creating healthy boundaries for students and for ourselves even, but we also need to have a broader conversation about the responsibility of these tech developers that make products that may not be supporting the well-being, or they're only reacting once something happens to a student where then they are seem to be concerned about that well-being. The issue that I think is really important then here is and that we hear from students and teachers is about the connection and relationships. And so we have distraction, we have disconnection that's existing peer-to-peer for students with teachers. And so we want to make sure that we're creating the kinds of experiences that help people, young people especially, feel present, feel engaged, feel seen, feel known, and that they know that relationships matter and there's healthy boundaries and well-being that they can seek.
Hannah, let's shift gears a bit and talk about one of the other headwinds that school systems in North Carolina and around the country are facing due to changes at the Trump administration level. They've been changing the federal government's approach to education and to education funding, and though they'd like to shut down the Department of Education, they are limited by law to simply neutering it in various ways. So how have they approached that? What has been the impact? And can those policies be rebuilt if they are found to be damaging to public education and a new administration comes to power with a different point of view?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the Trump administration isn't able to fully shut down the Department of Education. That has to be done by Congress. Their approach so far has really been through interagency agreements, which is when they kind of give oversight and authority to another department within the U.S. government. And so just last week, I think it was, we saw some more news about interagency agreements. Now the U.S. Department of Health and Services, Human Services, is going to be working closely with the Office of Special Education and Rehabilitative Services, and the Department of Labor is going to be working with the Office of Civil Rights. And so the Trump administration has really said this is an attempt to reduce bureaucracy, help give funding more directly to the states instead of the Department of Education. I think in practice, this has created a lot of confusion for school districts about, like, you know, who do I contact now? Who is my person if I have questions about federal compliance? And I think you're seeing that play out for parents as well. You know, who do I reach out to if something isn't happening correctly in my school district and I'm not receiving support from the state? Who do I go to? And so I think in this transition period, there's a lot of confusion. I think we're also seeing more questions about the reliability of federal dollars. Last July, there was about $7 billion held up nationally for school districts that ended up being released. But there was a few weeks where that wasn't certain. And so I think now there is some questions from school districts about how to count on funding. And in terms to your last question about rebuilding, there have been some researchers and advocates across the country who have really said, you know, it kind of would probably take 3 to 4 years to build back the Department of Education to what it was before this point. And so that would require probably the first term of any potential president who would want to put the Department of Education back to how it was.
So I have about 3 minutes left, and I don't want to leave out an important aspect of what's been going on in North Carolina before we run out of time. Last year, the General Assembly made opportunity scholarships available to all students, not just those who are in need, and it helps to fund private education to the school of a parent's choice, regardless of their ability to pay. And some feared an exodus of students from public to private schools as a result. And since these vouchers don't often pay the full freight of a private education, they feared that some of the economically stressed families would still have to remain in public schools, and that would leave only poorer students in the public schools. Has that proven to be the case, Hannah?
Yeah, I think there's still questions as this school year was the first like full school year that we've seen since the expansion. So far, we haven't seen a great exodus. About 8 to 12% of new recipients were found to have been prior public school attendees based on DPI's two annual reports looking at attendees and new scholarships since the expansion. I do also want to note, even though all students of all incomes can access the funding, there are still tiers based on income. And so it still is low-income students who receive the full scholarship of $7,000 plus, and students in the highest income bracket receive about $2,000.
But if I understand a chart that I think you published from the Department of Public Instruction, it shows that nearly two-thirds of the students moving from public to private schools using these scholarships were not economically disadvantaged. 61.8% were not disadvantaged, while 38.2% were. What does this tell us?
Yeah, I think a lot of the predictions we heard from people at DPI and other advocates have kind of been playing out as to what they've seen of expansion in other states. And that's largely that when there's this type of expansion, it largely goes to students already in private schools. And then that students might be offered the scholarship and this, they might not take it. And so there might be students who are lower income who are offered the scholarships, but due to other services and resources offered at public school, they ultimately decide to decline the money and stay in their public school.
And James, I have about 30 seconds left. State funding for public education is based in part on attendance, enrollment. Has enrollment at CMS or other surrounding systems been noticeably affected by these opportunity scholarships and the expansion of that program?
We've definitely seen declines in enrollment. At least CMS has attributed this mostly to birth rates. So the impact of opportunity scholarships kind of remains to be seen, but it has impacted the budget a little bit as well.
And with that, we have to stop. James Farrell is education reporter for WFAE News. Emma Broughton is director of digital learning at the Friday Institute for Educational Innovation at NC State University. And Hannah McClellan is the director of news and content for EdNC. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.